The din from Harvard Yard continues ever since Harvard's president, Larry Summers, asked whether innate differences between the sexes might explain the small numbers of female scientists and mathematicians at prestigious institutions. A sometimes angry debate has been underway on his campus and across the nation. Yesterday, President Summers met with Harvard faculty for the second time this week to try to shore up his leadership and patch up relations with his professors. Some of Summers' supporters ask, wasn't he just doing his job? Isn't a university president supposed to stimulate dialogue and challenge the sacred cows of academe? Today we step back from the Summers controversy to look at the role of college and university presidents. Should they be quiet consensus builders or loose cannons? What should or shouldn't be off limits? And how much does controversy get in the way of important tasks like fundraising, expanding enrollment, and building prestige? Later in the program, we'll look at the actual numbers of women in physics and at Dixie's slow fade in the South. But first, the job description of a college president. If you're involved in higher education or if you just have questions about what a college president actually does, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Scott Jasik, editor of the online publication Inside Higher Ed. Nice to have you back on the program, Scott.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Harvard is clearly an unusual case, but basically, what's expected of the typical, if there is one, college or university president?
Well, it varies a lot by institution, but their number one task tends to be to raise money. If they're a private college, they need to raise it from private donors. Public colleges are looking to legislatures. They're both looking here to Washington. And they want good press, not bad press. College presidents spend a lot of time worrying about what's going to create a PR disaster for themselves. Usually they're trying to undo something someone else did as opposed to stepping out of their own difficulties.
Yeah, some professor or adjunct professor comes up with some wacky theory and all of a sudden they're having a hard time with the state legislature.
Right, and that relates to their primary goal, which is making sure that the institutions have enough money to do their function. Now, people like to imagine the golden era of college presidents thinking great thoughts, and I think a lot of college presidents wish they could spend their time thinking great thoughts, but the odds are you'll find them on the road, going to where the money is, wherever their wealthy alumni are.
Well, you do think back to Larry Summers' sometime predecessor, James B. Conant, who was a national intellectual leader involved in many programs around the country.
Well, I mean, he'd be a perfect example. I mean, he created basically the impetus for the SAT, which, although it's controversial today, that led to the possibility of students from public colleges or from public high schools going at any significant number to higher education. So that was somebody looking at the big picture in higher education saying, we need a dramatic change. But one thing to remember is that change was controversial at the time. When people say, I wish college presidents would think great thoughts, sometimes those great thoughts may be things they don't like.
Mm-hmm. So, and again, Harvard, unusual in the respect that, I don't mean to put too fine a point on it, but they don't need the money.
They don't need the money and they don't need the attention. If you're Harvard, attention can only hurt your reputation. It can't exactly go up. So Harvard really is an anomaly. Most other colleges are desperate for the kind of attention and money that Harvard has.
At the same time, had this been said by the president of Neil Conan University and Elk's Breath, nobody would have paid any attention.
Well, I'm not sure I would say that. There are certain issues that are real hot-button issues. Some years ago, the then-president of Rutgers made a comment about black students maybe having more difficulty on the SAT, and that was a huge uproar. I think of things that are guaranteed to set people off, talking about innate differences by gender and race is one of them, and it's going to always cause a problem in higher education.
Now, who decides what kind of president to hire at various kinds of colleges?
A board of trustees, and then they will have a search committee. And it's important to remember that what may appeal to a board of trustees may not be what makes a president popular with faculty members or students. Boards of trustees tend to be dominated by people who are in the business world, who are very conscious of an institution's financial situation, and they may or may not be looking for a great builder or somebody to stabilize things, somebody to raise a lot of money, or somebody to tackle tough issues. Summers, interestingly, was hired, I think, to tackle some big issues, although I don't think they would have put women in science on the top of the list.
Interesting. We're talking about the hiring process. Tell me about the other side. When college and university presidents lose their jobs, presumably the majority of them are retired with great fanfare, but when they get fired, what do they get fired for?
It's hard to fire a president because, remember, a search for a president can take up to a year. And typically, it takes a while for a president to get momentum. So to say we made a mistake and we want to get rid of somebody is very costly for a college, not just financially, but it's destabilizing. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people who think that college boards may be too hesitant to say, we've made a bad decision here and we need to regroup. It tends to be a true uproar. Misconduct will do it. Or sometimes there's just an agreement that this is a bad fit.
Mm-hmm. Now, some university presidents seem a little bit like odd matches. For instance, you think of the former Clinton cabinet member, Donna Shalala, president now at the at Miami University, which is best known as a football factory.
Well, she actually has used sports very much to her advantage. She's a sports fan. And before she was in the Clinton administration, she was head of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And there she rebuilt the football team, or hired people who rebuilt the football team. And that gave her incredible popularity in the state and I think enabled her to carry out her agenda. People in Wisconsin who might not agree with her politics worship her for making Wisconsin a player.
Yeah, Barry Alvarez, I think,
yes,
is the name most closely associated there. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us is David. David's calling from Little Rock.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest.
Go ahead.
Well, the mention was that the job for college presidents is to raise money, and it's been suggested that it might be, you know, other things as well. But shouldn't the job for college presidents be just to be there for the faculty and staff and also the students to improve the education that they get there?
That's certainly an ideal world, and I think a lot of college presidents would like that. The reality is that I think they would say is that if they're not out there raising money, they'll have a tough time serving the students and faculty members. Student aid costs money. Faculty salaries cost money. We're in an era where government sources for higher education are tight, and colleges with ambition need money. It would be nice, I think, if higher education had all the resources it needs. It just does not.
But Scott, isn't that also why there's a dean and a provost as well?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as the president has become the outside person, lots of other positions, especially the provost, are more inside people.
Provost dealing with the faculty.
Dealing with the curriculum. There is concern, though, that there's been a trickle-down effect on the fundraising, that deans maybe in the old days weren't selected at all for fundraising ability. Now they have to do some fundraising. Even individual faculty members have to do fundraising. So But in looking at how people spend their time, I think you also have to look at a larger situation. Is there enough money?
David, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Is there any issue? You mentioned, obviously, any reference to innate abilities, either by sex or ethnicity or race, is a hot-button issue. Are there taboos that you just don't talk about?
I mean, that's what some people are saying, and a lot of Larry Summers' defenders are saying this is just PC run amok. I think, though, that a lot of people would say you can talk about tough issues, you can raise questions about these things, but you have to do it with some care. I think if you're going to talk about issues that are so sensitive to people, you want to be careful that you do have your research right, that it's clear what you're talking about, it's clear why you're talking about it, and if you mess up, you probably want to release your transcript right away and not hold on to it for a while.
Joining us now is somebody who knows this all from the inside. John McCardell is president emeritus of Middlebury College, and he's a history professor there. He's with us by phone from Beaufort, South Carolina, where he's on sabbatical. Welcome.
Nice to be with you. It is Beaufort, South Carolina, and I would be remiss to my local hosts were I not to say that we sing "O Beautiful for Spacious Skies," not "O Beautiful for Spacious Skies."
Okay, well, thank you for the
Chamber
correction.
Of Commerce thanks me for that.
All right. Now, when you left the job as a president of Middlebury College, you wrote a piece, an op-ed piece, that said, look, there were some things I really couldn't talk about when I was president.
That's correct. I think that Just picking up on the last couple of comments, I think presidents need to choose their issues very carefully, and they need to be prepared, whatever issues they choose, for a sustained conversation about them. And acknowledging the fact that there is only so much time, and there is only so many issues, and there is only so much political capital, I think that simply excludes from the agenda a great many things that, in fact, presidents would be very eager to talk about had they the time.
And one of the three of the things that you mentioned in your article in the New York Times was, college presidents should start talking about tenure. They should start talking about the drinking age. It's too high, in your opinion. And there are some other things you were concerned about.
Well, actually, the original draft of that essay had 6 points in it, but time's requirements allowed me only three. I do think that the three issues that I identified are all things that, in one way or another, fall into the category of shibboleths or conventional wisdom on college campuses. And since we're talking about things that presidents do, I feel very strongly that one of the things presidents do must do is to continue to force our campus public, force the wider public to engage in discussion of some of what passes for the conventional wisdom.
Even when that conversation could irritate parents, students, funders, and faculty.
Oh, absolutely. And my article has. All of the above.
Which is why perhaps we're speaking with you in South Carolina.
That's why I'm 1,200 miles away.
Safely. Well, the weather may have something to do with that as well.
Oh, slightly.
Hang on the line with us. So we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversations about the role of college and university presidents, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing what college and university presidents should do with their time. Is it just fundraising, or should they be responsible for, well, challenging some of the sacred cows of academe? Our guests are Scott Jasek. He's the editor of the online publication www.insidehighered.com, and John McCardell, the president emeritus of Middlebury College. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org, and let's get a caller on the line. Kai joins us from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Conan, and to your guests. Thank you for a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I'm a faculty member here in Columbus, Ohio, and my comment for this afternoon, and perhaps a question, is that it seems to me that the model of the university or the college's corporation has been detrimental at many effects, and I think presidents, because they've had to increasingly take on the role of sort of CEO or head fundraiser to balance the books, has not only been one of raising money, but they sort of become number crunchers. And so that if everything doesn't match up with the bottom line, then there's no room for it, perhaps. And in particular, it's sort of the risk-taking of ideas, perhaps, that has suffered in terms of doing past theater productions or art shows that have, sort of risky subject matter or risky material or controversial material. So presidents have to sort of, interfere, perhaps, even sometimes, and I can give specific examples from my experience, to say, well, we can't do this because it's going to affect the amount of money that we're going to be able to pull in. And it seems to me that the idea, because corporations, of course, have to make in a certain safety, and so the idea of the college or the university as a corporation, I think, is ultimately going to be very detrimental to a sort of a free-flowing milieu of ideas and exchange of sort of cutting-edge issues.
Kai, thanks very much. Due to the quality of your phone line, not to the quality of the question, we're going to have to let you go. But let me ask John McCardell, is Kai right? Is intellectual risk-taking, is the bottom line dictating?
Well, yes and no. There's certainly much of what he has said that is accurate. While we are nonprofits, we certainly must balance our books at the end of each year. I've always had pretty generous boundaries when it comes to matters of academic freedom and the freedom of discussion on campus, and I think that a president's role, particularly where public questions or controversial issues are involved, is to be careful about taking a stance that may or may not be his personally, but that no matter how much he may protest that it is, appears to be that of the institution. The role of the institution is to provide, it seems to me, the playing field or the arena for the competition of ideas, and the leader of the institution or the institution itself should take a position on those issues only, it seems to me, on very rare occasions and when the freedom of discussion is at risk. I think if that is the case and if that is the environment, then there ought to be plenty of room for healthy discussion about controversial questions, whether those be publications or works of art or political points of view. But there is no question that we do have to balance our budgets at the end of each year. I suspect that Kai's institution, like my own, however, has taken some risks over the course of its history. I would be astonished, for example, if his university didn't have a fair amount of bonded indebtedness it was paying off. That strikes me as a willingness to go beyond the conventional annual balancing of the books, to take risks, to make certain bets about the future, and to hope that if those educated guesses come off, the institution will wind up a much stronger place.
Scott Jasek?
The thing I was going to add is that people, when you hear about presidents spending all the time raising money, you think, oh, they're spending time with the rich people. But if you look at good things in higher education, wealthy institutions like Harvard, Princeton, public universities like North Carolina and Virginia have in the last few years announced huge expansions of financial aid programs for low-income students. Those are expensive policies, and they're paid for with money from their endowments and gifts. We can all wish that we were in a world where every low-income student had enough money to go to college. We're not in that world. And for college presidents who want to expand their programs, they've got to go out there and hustle.
Let me ask you both if the Larry Summers situation in Harvard is going to discourage college presidents from sticking their heads above the parapet. What do you think, John?
I don't think his situation in particular should have that that effect. I think there are other factors for the rest of us who perhaps occupied positions that may be less visible than that of the presidency of Harvard that militate against that. But I don't think that that has to do as much with concern over taking on a particular taboo subject, as I said before, the concomitant understanding that if one does take those things on, one had better be prepared, as I think President Summers has now discovered, for a protracted and sustained discussion of those issues.
I think it may discourage some people. When you're trying to raise money, you want to have as large a pool as possible of wealthy individuals you can go to. And you don't want to be writing anybody off because you've offended them on issue X or Y, especially when colleges are always at risk of having offended people for other reasons, like because the football team isn't winning or somebody's nephew didn't get admitted. So if you're trying to maximize the money you raise, you probably are careful about what you say.
Well, let's look at how much money Harvard brings in the next 12 months, and we'll have an answer to that question.
Okay. Let's get a caller in. This is Tom, and he's in Galesburg, Illinois.
Yes, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to maybe shift the focus of the discussion briefly. I shared with your screener that upwards of 60% of students in this country today that are attending higher education are, in fact, attending a community college. I happen to serve as president of the finest community college in Illinois, known as Carl Stammert College, and that drives a significant component of my day-to-day operations because in today's economy, it's been estimated that 80% of the jobs that will be available will require a post-secondary education, and typically it is the community college that is responding, is the first responder, at least, to the occupational retraining and training needs of tomorrow's workforce.
Scott Jasek, we talked earlier about the distinction between public and private universities. I neglected to ask about community colleges.
Well, I think the question is a very valid one. I don't know about how you spend your time, but when I talk to community college presidents, they are also having to spend a lot of time off campus, but it might not be in fancy clubs in New York City. They're with a local business leader talking about how can we add a job job training program that will help your industry, or they're with the mayor of the city talking about a local problem. Community colleges that are most, the reason I think they're so popular with so many local officials is because they're so responsive, and that's from their presidents being very much in the community, as I'm sure you are.
Well, it's interesting your program hit today because I'm, in fact, driving across my district today, which is 10 counties in west central Illinois. We cover nearly 3,000 square miles. And I like to refer to the community colleges as the MASH units of higher education. And what I mean by that is mobile academic service habitats. our mission is, in fact, to go where the need is at. And I'm just returning this afternoon from a meeting with a local school superintendent, a public school superintendent, in the rural settings in this country, where populations are dropping and having to cover vast rural areas, typically the community college presidents are figuring out ways of using our technological expertise that we have invested and spreading that network of reaching out to the public schools so that they can keep their upper-end curriculum alive, whether it be calculus or second year of French or what have you. But I just came from a high school district that has 67 students in it. And it's nearing to be impossible for the rural public schools in this country to keep their curriculum alive at a time when, again, these are the very young individuals that we're trying to pull through the public education system, if you will, and keep them connected so they can go on to the four-year institutions and complete their bachelor's degrees.
Tom, thanks very much. We appreciate the phone call. Drive safely now.
You bet.
Bye-bye. John McCardell, before we let you go, your op-ed piece mentioned three issues that you thought you might have wanted to talk about while you were president of Middlebury College: shrinking age, tenure, the importance of class size. You said the time constraints for the New York Times forced you to leave out three more. What were they?
Well, they had to do with what I think were less important questions involving, for example, my belief that athletics and academics are not mutually exclusive, that we need to go back and reexamine the pace towards which we encourage our students to proceed toward the degree, and we need to look at the composition of our requirements to make sure that we're preparing the students who come to us as best we can for the challenges that we think they're going to meet over the course of their working lives after graduation. All important topics, but one could pick only three.
John McCardell, thank you very much. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
John McCardell is President Emeritus of Middlebury College, joined us by phone from what I've learned to pronounce as Beaufort, South Carolina, where he's on sabbatical, and we thank him for his time. We turn now to another President Emeritus, John Silber, President Emeritus of Boston University. He served as BU's president from 1971 to 1996. He's a professor of philosophy and law there and joins us by phone from his office in Boston. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Throughout your career, you were never known to be shying away from controversy, but tell me, are there some subjects that a college or university president shouldn't talk about?
I don't believe so. I think that it's important to speak about those things in a responsible way, but I think the university is committed to open research for the truth, and there's no such area as forbidden knowledge. And consequently, anyone who wants to have an ideological barrier to a research project or a discussion of an issue because of some ideological reason, I think that person has got to be opposed. And if it's an issue on campus, then the president may have to be involved. For example, I think it was imperative that we maintain an open campus at Boston University where anyone who was properly invited could speak, provided you know they're not a criminal or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that gave us anybody from Angela Davis to somebody like Bill Buckley, and those were just free and open discussions. It was we had one condition on it. I put in a condition that we wouldn't pay any speaker more than $2,000, and we wouldn't pay a politician who was running for office anything, and no one who could speak on campus unless they were willing to stand for questions for at least a half hour after their talk. And it seemed to me if they didn't want to engage the students in questions and answers, that there was very little value in having them. And those were the only restrictions we had on who could speak.
Do you think, as a college university, former university president, is controversy inevitable when somebody's trying to change an institution?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that controversy probably goes hand in hand with anybody who's fully alive.
That's probably true. John Silber, there's an old saying that you can't please everybody all the time. Is that just life for a college president?
No, I certainly think it is. And you have to, for example, when we put a ban on overnight guests in the dormitories to prevent students from female students from inviting their boyfriends in for overnights, or male students for inviting their girlfriends in overnight in their dormitory rooms. When we put an end to that, we had some quite a few protests from students, and I even had some protests from parents. But that didn't matter. The overwhelming majority of the students were delighted to get a night's rest and not be forced into being voyeurs of a sex act they didn't want to see.
John Silber, President Emeritus of Boston University. Our guest also is Scott Jasik, editor of InsideHigherEd.com. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. James joins us from Sacramento.
Hi, yes. I was just listening to your discussion, and I was thinking about college presidents in the new U.S. World News the U.S. News and World Report ranking of universities. And more college presidents are being required to respond to rankings of universities, which I don't believe are productive, because you have a 200-year-old New England college responding to a ranking that ranks it up against a university in California that has a different educational style altogether. And they're actually, a lot of them are forsaking their personality, which they've built, into their structure, and it's actually detrimental to the institution.
The whole exercise there, I think, is fraudulent. The people that are asked to respond and to evaluate the various institutions couldn't pass a test on more than six of them or seven of them. I think that the way to expose that would be for somebody simply to sue at U.S. News and World Report for the damage that's been done by a low evaluation of an institution, and say, I want to call as witnesses the series of college presidents or deans who answered to their survey. And when they interrogated them on the stand, they would find out that the college president didn't know who was teaching philosophy or who was teaching physics, who was teaching even in the law schools or the medical schools of those institutions that they were trying to evaluate. The whole thing is really, really fraudulent. I've been sent that inquiry many times, and I've always refused to respond to it, because there was no way I could pretend to evaluate more than about 20 institutions. I got around more than most college presidents, and I knew something about maybe 20 institutions. But I wasn't even happy in going beyond about five.
Scott Jasik?
Well, I agree with Mr. Silber that the U.S. News rankings really aren't worth very much. I can't go along with his idea of suing the magazine, at least as a journalist. But
that's for fun.
But
it's to get the.
But I think you should
provoke
some
email anyway. Yes.
Yeah. But you should look at what's going on with the college president's time. To return to the theme of this discussion, a lot of college presidents do worry about their rankings in U.S. News, and you see college after college will issue press releases boasting about a jump of two notches among mid-Atlantic regional universities. I think the question for college presidents who complain about it is, you should say, are you boasting about it? Do you cooperate? And why? Mm-hmm. And I think then, and I also think journalists should not cite it as evidence of quality.
James, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, if I could suggest one thing quickly. I went to Trinity College, and we were compared to Middlebury and other colleges like that. But years ago, they created a consortium of colleges that would not compete athletically with all of the universities in the U.S., acknowledging that they've got different goals than other colleges. And I would think that if the consortium of colleges agreed not to be polled by U.S. News and World Report, then we could end up with a situation where, then no one would look to U.S. News and World Report to evaluate the status of whether something...
James, we've discussed this ranking system on other days. We will again. We're talking today about the job of college presidents, but we thank you for your call.
Right, thank you.
All right. And John Silber, we just have, 30 seconds left with you. If you had one piece of advice after this Larry Summers incident, what would it be?
I would say, don't apologize for telling the truth. It's the right of Harvard to investigate any subject they want, and anyone who has read carefully the transcript of his remarks will recognize that those remarks were very thoughtful. They were ironic. They weren't particularly provocative. And he never proposed to answer the questions that he raised. He proposed a series of studies. But I think he has weakened himself gratuitously by these series of apologies and promises to be a good boy in the future.
John Silber, thanks. John Silber, President Emeritus of Boston University, joined us by phone from his office. More on this after a break. This is NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about the job of a university or college president. Our guest is Scott Jasek, editor of InsideHigherEd.com. And here's an email question we got from Julie Niederer in Hilton Head, South Carolina. I graduated from one of the top private liberal arts colleges in the country. There were three different presidents during my time there, and I could say as a student, I never had any contact from any of them except in long, wordy letters, often about raising tuition and fees.
That's typical. Well, it's not typical how many presidents she had, but most college students don't really interact with their presidents. The chances might be greater at a small liberal arts college, but because the presidents are off campus, they're not going to get to know very many students. That is sad. It would be nice if the people running the institutions actually interacted on a regular basis, but it's just not the way things have evolved.
Let's get another caller on the line. Scott is with us from Jackson, Mississippi. Or Jackson, Michigan.
Jackson, Michigan.
All right. I was confused.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My question involves, you've been talking about a couple college presidents who have political backgrounds. What are their qualifications to become a college president, both educational and career-wise?
Most college presidents work their way up through academe, and so they're people who might have started off as a professor and then shifted to becoming a low-level administrator and then working up. We're seeing more presidents these days who are lawyers, more with business backgrounds, or people like Larry Summers who have extensive experience in government in addition to work in academe.
And, as you say, a lot of people do, though, come from the outside or go in and out.
Yes. I mean, at most colleges, it would be something of a taboo to have a president who had never spent time in higher education. A lot of faculty would resist a president who didn't have a PhD, but you do see examples of that.
Mm-hmm. And again, it has to do with what role whoever is hiring that college president wants them to perform.
Right. Even if they are going to be primarily a manager and fundraiser, you do want somebody who understands the core values of what a university is about, both when they're out raising money and when they're called on to deal with a crisis.
Thanks very much for the call, Scott.
Thank you.
And finally, Scott Jasek, before we let you go, how do you measure success of a college president, and how long after his or her departure is success measured?
I think during a presidency, a lot of boards measure it by the things we've been talking about. Do they have enough money? Have they avoided controversy? Are they getting good PR? But I think you have to look long term to see whether a president assembled the right people to create real change. If you look at, say, an institution like Duke University, which has shifted over a generation from being a good Southern university to a good national university, a lot of people think Terry Sanford in the 1970s and early 80s laid the groundwork for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in judging whether a president has been really a success, it may be after the president's gone.
And Terry Sanford got rewarded for that. I think he got elected governor.
Senator.
Ah, there
he was governor
better.
Before.
Yeah, okay. Scott Jasek, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott Jasek, editor of the online publication Inside Higher Ed, joined us here in Studio 3A.